Good evening. This is Marvin Granger from Montana State University, Billings, where we are gathered together tonight in Sissel Recital Hall to have the first in a series of programs on the humanities in education. There'll be future programs, and the next one I'll mention right off the bat will be on May 9th, which is also a Thursday night, and Dr. Hugh Kirtler will talk about his book, Recalling Education. So if you'd like to be in the audience for that program, I'll mention right now that you can do that by coming to Sissel Recital Hall beginning at 7:30 on May 9th. And then there'll be one in the fall on the Rocky Mountain College campus with Dr. Robert Proctor, who is coming back. He was here a couple of years ago. He is a Cicero scholar and will be lecturing and talking with an audience in the same sort of pattern that we have here tonight. The pattern that we have here tonight is a small audience on stage at Sissel Recital Hall. After Dr. Michael Barnes makes his presentation, and I'll let him tell you what his subject is, although we've been talking on the air about what he'd be saying, he may not say that. You know, it's all right. We didn't ask him for a specific title, so he has his own. He is professor of religious studies and has been, for the last 4 years, the alumni professor of humanities at the University of Dayton in Ohio. He is a graduate in undergraduate school from St. Louis University and received his PhD in religious studies from Marquette University. He has been at the University of Dayton since 1968. He's the author of his first book was called In the Presence of Mystery, 23rd publications, 1984 to 1990 and 1990, and An Ecological Spirit. He edited that. The Stages of Thought to the Coevolution of Religious Thought and Science, published by the Oxford University Press in the year 2000, and more recently, Theology and the Social Sciences, published by Orbis Books in 2001. And he's written numerous articles in his field. Why ask Michael Barnes to come here? The subjects of the humanities and of religion and of science have been of interest to me, and it was my idea to bring him here. There are other people who will be bringing other speakers here in the future for these humanities lectures. I've had an interest in religion and science for a number of years, being exposed to the theologian Paul Tillich when I was in undergraduate school, and then to the philosopher of science Herbert Feigl later on in my graduate years. They created questions that I've been wrestling with ever since, sometimes I think successfully and sometimes not. I want to, in presenting Michael, to just pass on here a couple of paraphrases to you. One of them is from scientist Paul Gross, who in paraphrasing Dubzansky said that no amount of evidence will convince anyone of the truth of anything if they are determined to believe otherwise. And that's very important to think about that, because we teach critical thinking. We also want, we respect the fact that people have beliefs, but on the other hand, we know that uncriticized beliefs can get us into big trouble. I need not give you examples at this moment in our history. And then I want to quote or paraphrase theologian Paul Tillich, who in talking about the positivist philosophers back in the 1950s, he accused them of constantly sharpening the knife of reason without ever cutting anything with it. That's a very important thing, too, because to bring somehow the critical mind to real issues, to questions that really matter, is not so easily done. And Michael Barnes is one of the people that I believe in the Stages of Thought has attempted to do that in a methodology that I found very, very interesting, and he'll be talking about that at some point. It is my pleasure to present to our audience here at Sissel and to our radio audience, Dr. Michael Barnes.
Thank you all, and thank you, Marvin, for inviting me. I haven't been in Montana since August of 1948. My family was escaping the Minnesota winters, and they paused here momentarily, but then moved on further to Oregon and California. They really wanted to get away from winter. But as I went through here, This place was kind of legendary in my mind. I was very young, but I knew already that a couple of my dad's ancestors had come to Montana. His great-grandfather, George W. Barnes, left the family after the Civil War, coming out here to make his living or to make his fortune or whatever. And one version is he was never heard from again. Another version is that he was hanged for a horse thief. My sister says, now we don't know that, to try to keep up the family honor. My father's maternal grandfather, Dan O'Grady, just abandoned the family, I have to confess, and moved to Montana. And he was killed in a logging accident. So all those many years ago, when I went through Montana, the image of this state in my mind is this is where my ancestors go to die when they leave the Midwest. And here I am from the Midwest. So be kind tonight. Thank you. The title of my talk is fairly general, The Evolution of Culture and the Role of the Humanities. I want to apologize for the pretentiousness of my name up there, Michael Horace Barnes, but there are about three other Michael Barneses in the field of religious studies, and I finally had to identify myself more specifically. What I would like to propose here is that we take it much too much for granted that we are able to live humanely with each other. There was a recent NPR, radio music show in which the host began by saying that philosophers think we're always just one step away from barbarism. And I think there's some truth in that, at least, and that's what I want to address tonight. The events of September 11th, of course, remind us that living humanely with each other does not always come easily to us. It has taken thousands of years of cultural evolution, I would like to claim here, to get to the point where we can now take our mutual, usual humaneness for granted, and perhaps to describe some of those steps in all that long cultural evolution of how we got here. Robert Keegan is the name of a man who has an interesting book entitled In Over Our Heads. And the theme of the book is that we're not equipped to live this kind of civilized life. We're not equipped by nature to do it. Our brains were wired back even 2 million years ago in our hominid ancestors for a certain style of life. And when we Homo sapiens sapiens showed up around 70,000 years ago, we then got to spend the next 60,000 years or so living a foraging life in small villages. And here we are today. Yellowstone County has something like 130,000 people in it. There are over 100,000 people in the city of Billings. That's not natural, folks. There's something that we weren't wired for in this. But nonetheless, we're getting along pretty well. So we've learned how to do something that our neurological wiring by itself may not be adequate for. I will talk eventually about the interplay between nature and nurture, between our genes and our culture. That's a long-standing argument. But before I get to that, I would like to run through the evolution of culture over the last, 20, 30,000 years, not being too ambitious here. We may skip a few points, not covering everything there is to say. The outline I have is an outline provided by Talcott Parsons, a famous sociologist, and he divided the stages of cultural evolution in this way. It's not the only way to do it, but it's a convenient way. First, there is primitive life, the life of the hunter-gatherer. Then archaic life, which is the odd name he used for city life, when people began to rely on agriculture and could live together in these huge concentrations of people, like 5,000 people in one town, and create other changes. In the archaic period, the appearance of literacy was extraordinarily important for all of us here today, and I'll talk about that in some detail. And then about 2,500 years ago, classical culture, his Talcott Parsons phrase is actually historic culture, but I find the word classical a little less misleading, gave us some special intellectual achievements that we are also still living off of. And then I'll say a few words about early modern culture, and finally some about our later modern culture, where we are today, in order to see whether or not this long, long development has provided us with tools for living humanely with each other, or whether civilization is really itself kind of an aberration. And you'll be able to judge that, and I imagine in your questions later on you might have some challenges to what I'm saying. So I'd like to start with primitive culture. One of the most famous of all the primitive cultures in the world today are the Yanomami. These are the tribal group made famous by Napoleon Chagnon. I thought for years it was Napoleon Chagnon, but he was raised in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So it's Napoleon Chagnon. Since the early 60s, he's been writing on this particular tribal group. There are three or four others that have books on them also, but he's the one that has gotten in the most trouble and whose name is most notorious for being associated with the study of this particular group. They are of especially good place to begin in talking about the evolution of culture, but I want to throw a cautionary word in first. Even the Yanomami, those who represent something like what we assume the early Stone Age culture was like, still are inheritors of a long prior kind of cultural evolution. I don't know if you want to call what happened to our hominid ancestors, who weren't quite fully human yet, as we think of ourselves at least, I don't know if you want to call what they did culture. Nonetheless, as early as 1.8 million years ago, they were making stone tools that require some skill to manufacture. And I'm getting ahead here. The next major step in using tools was around 1.5 million years ago, and using fire. The Neanderthals, our more immediate cousins or ancestors or relatives or whatever, they're still fighting over that one. Probably not our ancestors, but who knows what blood runs in our veins. By around 200,000 years ago, we're using more complex tools. And then by around 70,000 years ago, apparently from more recent evidence out of Africa, our real ancestors were using a wide variety of very complicated tools and various body decorations. There are signs here of that kind of intellectual spurt forward that says, that's us, folks. And the bones that go with it seem to say it also. Most of our ancestors, of those in this room, probably came from Europe, but of course, some may have arrived here long before some of these Homo sapiens sapiens finally began to expand out into the world. The question I want to raise is whether or not we have advanced over primitive life or not. Are primitive people naturally peaceful, or are they normally rather violent? There's an obvious point at stake in this whole question. If primitive people are usually rather peaceful, then the violence that we experience in the civilized world is probably unnatural. It's a mental aberration, something that civilization has done to our poor brains, and we need to get back to a more natural way of life. But on the other hand, if the civilized life we live now is less violent, then maybe we learned something. Maybe we have actually managed to improve through our cultural developments. A lot of anthropologists, after spending a year or two with some primitive people, have claimed that social peace is the rule. There are fights, there are disputes, there are divisions. But nonetheless, the anthropologists have pointed out all kinds of ways in which foraging peoples can be very politically astute. They are as intelligent as you and I. They cover the same range of human intelligence. So it's a matter of culture. Here are the words of one anthropologist praising the political acumen of a particular group. Artful speeches had guided the first step toward a peace, and lavish promises of exchange forged scores of social links among former enemies. This is the indispensable stuff of politics, reciprocity and obligation, the giving of goods and the promise of more, the creation of social indebtedness where none existed. And the anthropologist points out that in the process of doing all this promising and negotiating, people were very careful not to offend anybody, not to embarrass anybody. It was very, very diplomatically sharp. But the particular anthropologist reporting on all this happens to be Napoleon Chagnon, reporting on the Yanomami, the people who call themselves the fierce people, who like to think that they are incredibly deadly. Now, that may just be good public relations. If you live in a territory where lots of neighbors might want to pick on you, then calling yourself fierce is perhaps a good way to intimidate them. But in the long run, eventually, you have to follow up on that claim. Otherwise, you're going to be disbelieved. And Napoleon Chagnon figured out the best way to find out how many people were killed, how many were killers, how violent life was to do a careful count. And what he had to do was to find out how many males had died in the last 20 or 30 years. That was very difficult because you're not supposed to mention the names of the dead among the Yanomami. And some of his critics are really angry at him for going around and getting people to say the names of the dead. But he came up with an interesting kind of statistic that over the past 20 to 30 years, of all the males that could be named, 40% of them had died at the hands of somebody else. The homicide rate was very, very high among the Yanomami. Chagnon claims, as a matter of fact, that this is low in comparison with some other foraging groups. I was a little surprised at that. Melvin Connor, some years ago, reported on the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. You probably have seen the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy. The Kalahari Bush people, if that's the correct name, are represented as very peaceful, very loving, and they can seem so. If you live with them for a year or two, no homicides, perhaps because an outside anthropologist is living with them, but nonetheless, it doesn't seem like a high rate. But if there's a group of 50 people living together and half are males, and of those 25 males, a high proportion are children who aren't going to be killing each other or getting killed by anybody, and you look at the remaining 15 males and you check out over the past 10 years or so, or the past 20, how many males have been killed, boom, all of a sudden the statistics say a killing every other year is enough to say that half the men in this tribal group are going to die at the hands of other males. That's the kind of report that Connor gave. Robert Dentan is the name of an anthropologist that's produced a small book on the Semai, S-E-M-A-I, of the Malay Peninsula in Malaysia, obviously. And they called themselves extremely peaceful. This seemed to be an instance of a group of people who really were that wonderful, sought-after, naturally peaceful foraging group. Well, they called themselves really peaceful because they were raised to suppress any signs of angry emotions. They denied they were anything but peaceful. But when he went back, when Dentan went back and started counting, they had a pretty bad homicide rate also. So it doesn't look as though there's much sign of natural peacefulness among foraging cultures. But has civilization really improved things? It may be that foraging people are dangerous, and so are we. I mean, after all, think of all the things we've done, the Holocaust, the genocides, the ethnic cleansing just in the 20th century, and go back over the history of what was once called man's inhumanity for man, but I guess men actually should take most of the blame most of the time. I see a couple of women nodding, but trying hard not to gloat. So let's keep going and see what the overall record might be by going to archaic cultures. Archaic culture begins with the invention of agriculture. There's some dispute about whether cities came first or agriculture, but they came about the same time. And agriculture makes it possible for larger groups to live together in one place and stay there sedentary. They can store the grain in large vessels and keep it there for the dry season and so on. But as soon as you get large groups of people coming together, one of the things that seems to happen very quickly, unavoidably perhaps, is that there's a division into classes. Primitive people are strenuously egalitarian. Nobody gets to claim too much primacy over anybody else or a greater share of the resources. They will get attacked if they try that too hard. More gentler means for doing that are often available, though. But when you have city life, you get the rulers and the ruled, and perhaps some slaves on an even third level. And one of the interesting signs of how a change in our cultural context can affect our way of thinking is that archaic culture with categories of rulers and ruled may have produced the gods. Primitive people are sometimes said to have high gods, but I think a more careful look at the record says that's not true. You don't really find gods, superior beings in the spirit world, until you also have kings or rulers in the human world, major chieftains. When culture changed, we changed our ideas also, apparently, of what the spirit world is like. And polytheism has a long, long history down to today, so simple changes can have lots of influence. But I think in particular, of all the things that occurred during the period of archaic culture, it is literacy that is really extraordinarily powerful. There is a wonderful linguist and archaeologist at the University of Texas named Denise Schmant Besserot. I guess that's how to pronounce the name. I've never met her. She did detective work in ancient Sumer, whatever the correct pronunciation is, in the Mesopotamian Valley. And she says that there was a sequence of things that led to writing that was rather long and drawn out. As long ago as 8,000 BC, there were little clay tokens that were used, one kind to stand for a sheep, another for a jug of oil, another for a goat. And down to 4,000 BC, you still had these little tokens in use. Over the next 500 years or so, apparently people started putting these little tokens inside clay spheres, hollow clay spheres. And her guess is that the tokens were used in business arrangements. I promised to deliver 8 sheep. Only somebody along the line was cheating. So if you put the tokens inside clay and you bake it, then you crack the clay open at the appropriate moment and you find out what the contract really said. Well, that worked for another 500 years or so. And then somebody came up with a brilliant idea. Why don't we take the clay we're working with and instead of making these complicated spheres and all the rest, just press the tokens into the clay so there'll be symbols of the tokens. And you can say that here's 4 sheep coming to you. Writing has started. Somebody had figured out if you put little marks on a surface and bake it so it's, or keep it reliable somehow, you can communicate ideas. Even then, even when they had writing at hand, they still didn't get it very right. It took a lot more steps. The earliest writing was about things, like those little tokens that I spoke of. And then there was writing that was about objects and numbers, when you get a bunch of them in a row. And then eventually there was some genius that figured out the little markings we make don't have to stand only for objects. Maybe we can have some that stand for sounds. And so you get the beginnings of a phonetic alphabet. But even then, it didn't occur to anybody to put vowels in. And so even in 1800 BC, when Hammurabi's famous code of law was written, it's all consonants. There's no vowels. And so if you see 3 consonants in a row, I'll switch to English. My ancient Sumerian or Akkadian or whatever is not very good. I don't know it at all. Don't. In English, you see S, H, P. What's the word? I'm hearing sheep, ship, shop, shape, or my dog Shep. Who knows? So vowels are very, very good. Now notice how many, not many years, but centuries it's been since somebody invented the idea of writing, and they're still having trouble with the concept. It's not until around the 9th century BC when the Greeks luck out. They borrow a Phoenician alphabet, and they have some alphabet left over, And so they use it to stand for some of their vowels, and all of a sudden they have a completely functioning phonetic alphabet. But this is a couple thousand years of developing. Writing may be obvious to us, but boy, it sure came hard to the human race. It took an awful lot of time to get it. And of course, you and I actually have in our own life history something that's part of that kind of experience. Everybody in this room probably has been to 12 years of school. Some of you more. In your senior class in high school, did you all get A's on all of your writing assignments after 12 years of practicing? You wrote little essays. You wrote what you did in the summer. You wrote. They corrected it. And we still don't get it all right. Writing doesn't come easily to us human beings. That seems to be an unnatural kind of skill also. But it's given us an awful lot. It's given us immense amount. It has given us the ability to have longer, more complicated stories than merely folk tales and brief myths. Now we can think about things in a protracted kind of way. In fact, the number of things that writing does to us is extraordinary. I don't know if you've ever considered what life would be like without any kind of writing. You couldn't look anything up. Nothing. If you wanted to know how to handle a rare situation that hadn't come up in 40 years, you had to hope that you were lucky enough to have somebody really old around, somebody over 50, somebody who had a memory of an occasion like that in the past and could tell you what they did then and maybe actually have an answer. When we're talking face to face, we can use gestures, we can explain, we can do the equivalent of finger pictures of whatever it is we want to explain. We can interrupt each other and ask questions. Can't do that with writing. What writing makes us do is to try to pretend that we can be in the mind of 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 people we don't even know. And we have to sort of imagine what they might be thinking, what vocabulary they do or do not have, what kinds of things we have to make clear, what kinds of logical order is necessary because they can't interrupt to ask. Learning how to write, even up to 12th grade level, is an extraordinary intellectual challenge. One of the things that may have happened because of that is that we moved on to a new stage of culture. Back around 2500 BC, there was a major shift in thought in China, in India, in Greece, and a couple of other places that was so dramatic that a philosopher named Carl Jaspers called it the Axial Age, as though all of human history turned on its axis at that point. I don't think it really turned. I think it merely added. We are all still primitive. We are all still archaic. And I think that's good. We're carrying that richness around with us still. But what was added was terribly important. There's a number of elements in this classical culture. First of all, an intellectual elite began to speculate on whatever it might be that was ultimate. This was not merely a set of stories about this or that original being or beings that has started this part of life or made this ocean or got this crow flying or whatever. It was a question of what's beyond all those particulars. What's the ultimate stuff out of which everything was made or the ultimate cause of everything? And so you have the great religions or philosophies of China and India and Greece and Judea taking a shift at this point to ask about the single ultimate behind everything else. Secondly, that same intellectual elite began to worry about what philosophers now like to call the conditions of knowledge. How do we know what we know? How do we know our knowledge is correct? How do we know our method of getting this knowledge is valid? That's about as abstract as you can get, by the way. These are, in a sense, ultimate questions in the order of knowing, but they showed up around this same period of history. One form this took is the search for a set of rules so that you can know when your knowing is doing what it's supposed to be doing and doing it right. Aristotle probably did the biggest job of this with the massive logic he created. But if you read the ancient texts of China and India around the same time, they also had their own concerns about how to construct the rules for right thinking. And so we still inherit that. Everybody everywhere, by the way, uses logic. Primitive people use logic. This isn't something that began 2,500 years ago, but it's rather attempts to formalize logic, to stand back from our ordinary everyday logic and say, hey, how are we doing that? And how can we do it better? That you find first 2,500 years ago. A third aspect of classical culture is the use of abstract analysis where stories used to hold the field. Primitive people tell folk tales to describe how the world is and how people should act. Literacy gave people the power to extend and complexify these stories, telling grand myths about the gods and human life, usually in the form of poetry. Sometimes the archaic grand myths layered a lot of the old folk tales together to make a bigger story. But narrative is not the only way to express ideas. This axial age was a time when essays were born, abstract analyses. The kinds of analyses that you learned, for example, in geometry class, when you had to figure out logically whether or not two parallel lines could meet in infinity. I never have figured that out. To me, it never seemed logical or illogical, but just setting up the question that way was an attempt to work things out in an analytical way. Fortunately for us, it was not just analysis that took over and replaced narrative. Fortunately for us, narrative itself thickened. And this is the time in history when you have great epics like the Ramayana of India. By the way, don't trust my pronunciation on anything Indian. I have a Hindu student in class, and I talked about the Ramayana, and everybody in the class sort of knew what I was talking about because they'd been reading from it. And he finally asked me, and so I summarized the plot again, and he said, oh, of course, you mean the Ramayana, or something like that. He tried to teach me how to say it, but the last consonant is something that's utterly beyond me. I'm going to use somebody else's name in a minute, too. Still from the Hindu tradition, the Katha Upanishad, don't trust that pronunciation, tells a story of a young man, Nakikitas, I suppose. For all I know, what I'm saying is my shoe is broken, the way I pronounce it, but that's not my intent. But there's a wonderful story that's a mixture of theoretical analysis, but still old-fashioned drama. Nakakitas' father, in a rash moment, promises him as a sacrifice to death. And so Nakakitas, an obedient son, in many of these stories, there are moral images, ideals that are held up. As an obedient son, he goes to death and says, here I am, I'm ready. But he asks, as long as I'm here, before I die, will you tell me something? Tell me about the fire ritual that all the priests perform. What does it really mean? He's very curious, very inquisitive. And so death explains it to him. And then the young man keeps asking more questions. And death is intrigued by the curiosity. And so death keeps explaining. And they go further and further into ultimate questions. It's a nice tension. There's a lot of intellectual exposition going on. But is the young man going to live or die all the way through this? You're not sure. The final lines, actually, are wonderful for a Hindu, I suppose disturbing for most of us in the room. I'm not sure. But it says at the end, Nikakitas surmounted all the limitations of our ordinary knowledge and was willing to accept anything. Neither death nor life mattered anymore. He sought the ultimate. So I guess he died. I'm not sure, but it didn't hurt, something like that. At the same time that was taking place in India, parallel things were taking place in China, and you know of the Greek dramatists, so I won't try to go into details there. In fact, I'm now going to leap over 2,000 years. There's all kinds of things to tell about the next 2,000 years, but it would take us quite a bit of time. And you're willing to stay until 10 tonight, you said? No, all right, I know we have different kinds of limitations. So I'll jump to early modern thought. Around 1600 to 1800 in Europe, the period of the Enlightenment, it's an odd kind of time. two conflicting currents showed up almost immediately. One is a search for certitude, for dogma, in a time of the Reformation and uncertainty when people were upset. The whole new world was throwing information at them and they didn't know how to handle it all, so they wanted to get the right answers to everything. And at the same time, they had discovered some ancient texts about skepticism. And there were all kinds of reasons to believe that maybe we couldn't ever know anything for sure. And those two tensions appear by 1600, they appear in the 1500s, and they're with us right down to today. And so to jump again, how many of you here, I'm not sure how many in the larger listening audience, have heard the word postmodernism? Okay, that terrible word. It's so hard to figure out what it is. We barely have a handle on what's modern in order to figure out then what is postmodern. I'm going to talk about late modern thought and contrast it with postmodernism. And I'm going to hope to make simple sense out of it, but I'm probably going to be very unfair to somebody's position in doing that. You'll have to put up with that, I guess. There are people today who are very much like the moderate skeptics. They agree we can achieve only highly plausible conclusions. And one of the places they point is modern science. And it's precisely on modern science, not the only place, but on modern science that the late modern approach and the postmodern approach can often be distinguished. Back around 1600, Descartes and his buddies were looking for certitude. And that's why Descartes did that weird thing, of course, of doubting everything, so he could find something that was so certain he could build other certitudes on top of it. And when some people started doing a kind of science that didn't give certitude, like some of those weird British people, like Isaac Newton, there were lots that said, no, that's not good enough. We want proofs of why this has to be true. Well, what has happened over the last 400 years or so is that science has been very successful, but it's in this odd position of not being able to prove that its conclusions are true, because all it can really say is, so far, so good. Now, sometimes it can say that so wonderfully well that it would just be ridiculous to be skeptical. The Mendeleev periodic table of all the elements, less than 150 years old, and at the time it was constructed, they only knew 63 elements. But boy, has it worked well. It could predict where to look for the other elements and how they might behave. It took a while to make some other adjustments. Isotopes were a very odd kind of thing to have to take care of. But generally speaking, the table, the periodic table of elements, is just so brilliant, so reliable, works in so many different situations in so many ways that you can say it's been field tested to death. And so, technically speaking, philosophically speaking, you can say, well, so far, so good. We might discover some odd subatomic thing going on or some new odd quantum thing that makes us call significant aspects of all of it into question. On the other hand, we're going to use this. We're going to use the periodic table as though it is the truth because it is so wonderfully successful. Now, that's a kind of skepticism, but a very moderated skepticism. I'll call it just an openness to new ideas, a willingness to adapt when the evidence comes along that says it's time, but meanwhile, a high degree of confidence in what has worked so brilliantly well in so many ways. Postmodernists, on the other hand, are those who would say, hey, look, you can't prove that science works, and so tomorrow it might change radically. We might have to get, and here's the famous word you all know, a whole new paradigm in this field or that. Well, you can see where my sympathies lie. I think that modern science has worked so well that only a moderated skepticism is really justified. And the cultural relativism and the scientific relativism of the postmodernist position really doesn't hold up that well. So where does that leave us in discussing humanities? I've been off seemingly on a tangent for a while here about late modern thought, postmodernism, and science. Well, I think fortunately that the experience in science taught us that confidence in our ideas is good, dogmatism about our ideas is not good. And with that extra edge of openness, I think it has fed into something that's pretty common now, and that is a sense that we have to appreciate those who are different from us. We have to be aware that what seems strange and unfamiliar nonetheless might turn out to be really interesting and contribute a lot to whatever we have so far. And the other great area in which this occurs, I believe, is literature. Living somebody else's soul, living somebody else's feelings and thought, and being told, it's good to do that. Don't draw back from those that seem so odd to you. Learn to see how they're thinking and feel what they're feeling, and maybe your own life will be enriched, and maybe you will treat people around you differently. We're at a point now in the history of culture where we teach our kids, don't mock people who are different. Not all cultures do that. The Orani, a Brazilian foraging tribe, one of the obvious problems of having a deformed child is that it's too demanding on resources, so you probably want to kill it. And there was at least one report from one person who claimed, one anthropologist I read, that one of the methods used to be to give the deformed baby to the older children and let them beat it to death. You have to be tough anyhow, and there's no use being sentimental. I don't know how true that is, but at least we go in the opposite direction. Don't mock, don't make fun of, learn to accept. It took, as far as I can tell, something like 5 or 10,000 years of cultural development to get to the point where we now take that kind of education of children for granted. And so I'm pretty happy we've come as long as we have. There are hard lessons to learn. Mutual tolerance, appreciation of differences, living together in peace. I think all the many centuries of learning logic, literacy, philosophy, religion, history, literary reflections have given us a degree of wisdom we don't even realize we have. We are so used to those 12 years of grade school and high school and all those teachers who had to go to college to learn how to teach us how to do those things, and all those other teachers who had to go to graduate school to train the teachers in college how to do these things, that we're living layer upon layer upon layer of resources from the past that makes us able to live together, I think, a lot more humanely. Let me end with just some words that struck me, that surprised me, that fascinated me, kind of. I ran across them in the paper the other day. They're excessive. They're sentimental. I love them. They are words from a man named Kent Keith. Do you know the name? I had never heard it before. He published these rules in 1968 when he was a counselor in college and was at running some seminar for students. And I'll just give you a few of the rules. Number one, people are illogical, unreasonable, and self-centered. Love them anyway. Number two, if you do good, people will accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Do good anyway. The good you do today will be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Honesty and frankness make you vulnerable. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building may be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. Right. There are five more such rules, but you get the idea. In fact, they're coming out in a book, apparently, if I can do a plug for him, I have no idea who he is, called Anyway. I would like to see how he develops them. Now, those rules are dumb. They're unrealistic. They'll get you killed. You will be used and manipulated when people learn that you're one of those anyway type people, right? And yet, actually, I think most of us in this room feel that we can probably trust each other not to take advantage. We may have to look out for the 20th person or the 30th. That's one of the complexities of culture. But boy, we've come a long way. And I think the evolution of culture has got us here, and I'm kind of happy about that. Thank you.
We come now to the discussion part of our program, and I know from a few people in the audience that I've heard speak about various issues related to what Michael had to say, that there will be some differing of views here. I certainly hope so. We have two people with portable microphones, and would you raise your hand if you would like to be a questioner or a commenter? You can do either one. You can make a speech here. It's entirely allowed, and I see no hands. Brian, get a microphone over here.
I found your remarks very, very interesting. Read an abstract of a book you wrote on some of the same issues. My comment would be that your analysis of, quote, primitive cultures, end quote, is pretty thin. I'm not saying personally, but just two or three cultures. I've read a book by Hugh Brody on hunter-gatherers in the North, different conclusions. Two questions. The use of the word primitive is a charged word. It seems to me one could use other words. I'd like to comment on that. Second question, is the level of violence that you hypothesize from this fairly narrow analysis essential to your point, which is we're becoming more human, it's cumulative, culture humanizes, makes us more tolerant?
Two things. First, on the word primitive, I know it is a charged word, and for some years I stopped using it, and I would use words like foraging culture and primordial and so forth. I found that after I used one particular word for a couple years, though, the students started giving it their own spin. I knew somebody many, many years ago in Dayton, Ohio, who was a gay man with two sons and tried to explain to them that. And he said that after a half an hour discussion, that his two boys were very good about it. They understood that he loved them, that there was all kinds of complications. But they had one final request for him to make, and that was, please don't use that word. And the word was gay. A word that had been liberating for a while, already that quickly, had turned out to have its own meaning. You may be right. It may be that I shouldn't use the word primitive. I just have this sense that whatever we do talk about will tend to take on that kind of connotation, as long as we associate certain behaviors or limitations with the word we use. And that's the major point you're raising in the second half about whether or not my description is adequate. First of all, what I said here today is definitely not adequate. There's been recent books on foraging cultures and hunting-gathering cultures. There are hot arguments in anthropology, as you may well know better than I, between what I think of as the romantics and the rationalists about how we should respond to the plight of all sorts of people who live a much simpler life, a foraging life in the middle of this world. The particular group that I have focused on, I think partly because it's safe, because it's far away, are the Yanomami and some other tribal groups in the Amazonian rainforest. The Aborigines of Australia and the Highland people of New Guinea are some others that would be relevant. But as far as I can tell, the life is one that is meaner in its effects on the people, harder in terms of the level of violence, the amount of attacks between people. One of the common elements that may well, I said I was going to talk about genes and I didn't because of the time constraint, that may well be part of our genes is the tendency that seems to show up in all the, I'll say foraging groups now, of people who live simple lives, and all of us too, by the way, when an event takes place, to be fairly sure that someone caused it, that this is not accidental. And so what the Yanomami, among many others, do is immediately try to figure out who has done this. It might be a spirit being. There's whole sets of answers of which spirit might have stolen their child's spirit and killed the child thereby. But the other answer is sorcery. Their enemies in their own tribal group, in their own village, or in one of the neighboring villages to get even for some killing that goes past a few decades. And so there's this cycle of revenge that also, by the way, seems to be part of our human makeup, because it happens in so many cultures, that life is pretty rough for those people. Now, what do we do? All kinds of suggestions come up. One is to do the equivalent of quarantine them to keep them simple. We don't have a right to do that, I think. They have the right to choose what they're going to adapt from us. I think the limitation is we don't get to tell any other group what they should or should not take from us. But is it in their interest, for example, to take literacy from literate cultures, whether they do it in the highlands of India from literate parts of India, whether they do it in the highlands of New Guinea from literate parts of New Guinea, and so on? Well, obviously, there's lots of examples. As Jared Diamond points out, thank you, the children of some of the foragers that live on the mountaintops in New Guinea are now flying jet airplanes. But that's because they had to become literate first. And so it's very complicated knowing how to respond. We want people to have their own culture, and we want to treat them with respect, and yet there's lots of things going back and forth here. I don't know if that's an adequate response to what you had in mind.
All right. We get the microphone over here to Bill, and then we'll get it over here. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention Jared Diamond, and you beat me to it.
Oh,
Claude Lévi-Strauss rather vociferously rejected the concept of primitivism back around 1964.
The concept of?
Primitivism.
Right.
And I think you probably have already read The Third Chimpanzee.
Yes.
In which he makes a list of the major massacres of recorded history. And it does not seem that we're getting any better than we ever were in his list of major massacres and murders.
I wondered about that, how you were so optimistic at the end after you'd gone through the Holocaust and Rwanda and all these things. Can you reconcile that for us?
Maybe not. You're offering me the same criticism that one of my colleagues did. He said, Barnes, you're far too optimistic. This is ridiculous. And he started reciting all these things. Fortunately, most of them were already in my prepared remarks. I don't know how to do this. One way is to do it mathematically. Even with the ethnic cleansing, genocide, and Holocaust, and even with the terrible terrors of China and Stalinist Russia and so forth, are 40% of all the males dying at the hands of other human beings? I don't know what the numbers are. And of course, just doing it by numbers also is not adequate, because we seem to be showing that we have retained the ability to blithely kill one another, maliciously kill one another, under the right circumstances. And so we are probably still barbarians, not too far under the surface. And that makes it all the more important, I guess, that we learn all the things we can from whatever cultural heritages are available to keep that barbarian in the cage, if caging is the right answer, or on a leash, if that's the right answer, or tamed and whimpered with a little treat every day of some sort, like a new video game.
We have a question or a comment over here.
You talked about the legend from the Upanishads about the loyal son and his obedience. A very similar story in Judaic history, of course, is Abraham and his son Isaac being sacrificed. Those cultures probably, those in the frame of history, those two cultures probably were developing those sets of values probably at about the same time in chronological history, or at least within a reasonable time frame of one another. Do all civilizations, do all cultures develop those things within a predictable framework? And do all cultures develop those same sets of values at some point? If not, why not?
I like the last part, if not, why not? Good. One of the things I tried to be very careful about in working through my own analysis was not to claim too much. And the first thing I can say is there is an awful lot I know I don't know. And another thing I tried to be careful of is to avoid a kind of 19th century aspiration to work out the laws of history, of what's bound to happen next and so forth. And the more I go in the direction of even attempting to answer your question, I fear I'm going in that direction. Nonetheless, with all that cautionary stuff at the beginning, I was impressed some years ago with the work by Michael Cole and Eleanor Scrivener and a bunch of others trying to apply Kohlberg's theory of moral development to to a variety of cultures in the world, and they seem to have produced fairly consistent results, and that is where you don't have literacy, you don't get the kind of moral stage explanation that is represented by Kohlberg's last three stages of the six, let's say. The numbers have varied. It looks as though, again, something about literacy and logic or the schooling that goes with it, what it is, I don't know, pushes people beyond taking care of their own family and tribal group above all, out into this really weird and probably not always successful notion of appreciating the stranger, taking care of the one that's not part of your group, the Good Samaritan image in Christian tradition sort of thing. Is that an answer? Do you have more you'd want to?
I guess, well, yes, up to a point, but what I'm interested in is, I guess, at what point do the values that are for survival needs or the tribal good or the common good of the community, at what point, which is where you sort of stop, do they transform into something that would be considered more ephemeral, something more ascetic or aesthetic in its purpose, something that transcends just the need to survive? So I guess maybe that's the point at which religion or spiritualism comes into the mix.
I see. Okay. I could think of four or five questions you might be asking, but that would be one of them. You provoked something that was in my original remarks also that I skipped over because of time, that I want to throw it in because it's sort of relevant. My dad raised our family to be Irish. Actually, only three of my eight grandparents are Irish, but there were three of his. Therefore, we were an Irish family. And so I always thought of myself as Irish. And I was a little shocked not too long ago when I was reading in a long article, I think it was in the New York Review of Books, about Afghani culture, about the warlords, about the constant feuding, about the cycles of revenge, about how difficult life could be, even before the fragmentation that was caused by the war with the Russians, if you were living in a mountain city. And what the article did was to say, boy, this sounds exactly like a description of 17th and 18th century Irish chieftains, that all these Irish kings that I heard about were warlords, that they were leaders of a clan and they spent an awful lot of time killing each other. And they knew their enemies were right over the hill. And you go down through history and you begin to realize the Somali warlords and the Irish warlords and the Afghan warlords. This is normal behavior. Now, how do we get from there to here? Is it spirituality? I think that's a good word for some aspects of it. It depends on what you mean. I'm trained in theology originally, and my favorite Catholic theologian, Karl Rahner, says that the act of thinking about ourselves as thinkers, of being aware that we can transcend our limitations, that we can stand back from ourselves and make free choices, is the root of spirituality, of what it means to be spirit. And I think we began to do that with literacy. I think we began to do that when we developed philosophy and new stages of religion, not just the polytheism, but the question of, why are the gods so mean? And boy, how do I get to judge that the gods are mean? Where am I getting that morality from? Is that it?
Walt?
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. It's a very good book. Yeah.
I was just going to mention Guns, Germs, and Steel, talking about Jared Diamond. I think one of the points he makes in that book is that our food supply is very important in determining whether we're peaceful or not. That's really a driving force in history. And so therefore, where there is adequate food, perhaps there are more peaceful relationships. And where there is not enough food, humans are more aggressive, fear rises into the factor, you would have more competition, more killing. So I'd ask you if you'd agree with that, first of all. But then I'd say, secondly, that I'd wonder about the use of Chagnon as a model for what you're calling primitive, because he's certainly one of the most controversial anthropologists people who've been in his class in UC Santa Barbara talk about him as maybe a bit fascist, and certainly his analysis of the Yanomami is very controversial. So I'm just wondering if that's a very good choice to use.
Okay. First question again, my mind slipping. What's the?
I was talking about food supply.
Food supply. I don't know. I don't think I know enough history to answer that. As you asked that question, both sides came to mind. I read one report that claimed that the reason why the ancient feud, exacerbated by the French in the 20th century, between the Tutsi and the Hutu in Rwanda, had finally come to the boil because of overpopulation on too small a piece of land. And so everybody was on edge, and they were going to find an outlet. They were going to blame somebody in that old rule. On the other hand, when Greece was rich, when they had lots of good food supply, that gave Alexander the base, allowed him to go out and conquer everybody. So I'm not sure which way this comes down. Marvin Harris has some interesting theories, too, about the material basis for all kinds of cultural events, and I don't know how it added up. The second one, yeah, I followed the Napoleon-Chagnon controversy. What's Tyranny's first name? Darkness in El Dorado is the name of his book, attacking Chagnon. Patrick Tierney, I think, and followed the fight in the American Anthropological Association. I may not know enough to really be a good judge on this one either, but boy am I persuaded that Tierney is wrong and Chagnon is correct in his claims. I've also heard that he's very opinionated, dogmatic, fascist, maybe a word that some students would want to apply to him, right, and that he does not treat his opponents kindly. But I don't know that that means that he's incorrect in his description of the people. I think that'd be a different question.
Richard Wagner and Miles Davis were despicable human beings who were great artists. I mean, just fact of life, you know.
Do you think the influence of women, females, in our society today can be part of your reason for optimism?
Yes, definitely. I subscribe, at least partly, I don't want to overstate this, but I subscribe at least partly to the testosterone disease theory of an awful lot of violence in history. Of one of the common things of most of the descriptions I've seen of foraging groups and archaic cultures and so forth is the group that you have to tame somehow are the young males. They are so dangerous, partly because they're not mature enough to know how stupid they are behaving when they behave aggressively, angrily, righteously, and so forth. In a sense, I suppose the Taliban are one more instance of this. The young males who have a cause and who don't have the restraint, but all those puberty rites throughout history that tell the young males, your future depends on obedience to us older people, are undoubtedly incredibly wise. I was reading about the Cheyenne culture a couple days ago, and they seem to have even a better solution. You treat the 13 to 15-year-olds as on the way to becoming adults, and you keep them so busy helping out, both in hunting and in warfare, that they feel they're part of things, and all that natural energy is used up. Of course, that's a peculiar cultural context, and every culture makes a difference.
And that was farm and ranching life for a lot of people. Okay. Probably right here grew up that way as part of a job to be done, you know, and there was no distinction about...
Yes.
I have a question. I would actually like you to extrapolate a little bit on the future. These next 100 years, in particular, to borrow one of your own phrases, a new paradigm, very much could be on the line, both genetically and in the development of artificial intelligence. And if we end up in a century where we're questioning at the genetic level exactly what it means to be human, what then happens to the humanities or civilization in general? And I think how will we treat people who are genetically engineered? What will happen in an instance where you could have a population where the richest 2 or 3% are genetically perfect, for a lack of a better word, or machines that will do thinking for us? What in the next century will be the big thing for us in the field of the humanities?
25 words or less.
Yes, right. Obviously, all I can give you is a couple possibly relevant thoughts rather than an answer to that. Among my students, one of the big arguments is whether or not we should avoid playing God and do our best just to keep us as we are. We are human. This is what human is. Let's be this. And the other, a minority group actually, says, no, no. You know, this is kind of interesting, all the possibilities for the future. Start out, of course, getting rid of some inherited diseases, but then maybe, and now we're down to about 2% of the class, let's go ahead and explore. And the response I find I have to give them is that somebody's going to do that exploring and it's probably out of our hands. Technology makes its own path. The best that we can do is to be aware that in 100 or 500 or something like this number of years, there's going to be things happening that are really going to make us question what it is to be human and what the limits of humanness are and when the android is or is not human and everything we ever asked about data or asked about the little boy and AI, artificial intelligence. And I think that means it's important that our moral response to the possibility of changing humans should not be, let's not do it. Because if that's our response, we're not going to be thinking ahead of how to do it well instead of just stumble across and end up doing it, end up doing all kinds of horrible things.
Well, one way of looking at it is that simply, if we are to survive, we will at some point have to, because we will have to leave the planet Earth. If humanity is to, in fact, survive throughout the millennia, sooner or later, we're going to have to leave Earth, and the only way that we're going to be able to do it is to manipulate ourselves at the genetic level to be able to withstand that.
You're saying we'll have to leave it because of pollution?
No, simply because, I mean, down the line, the Earth isn't going to be there anymore. It's sort of a finite system.
Oh, Montana's a big city, you mean. Yeah.
I figure that's a billion years off. I've got other problems I'm worrying about first. Not that I have answers for them either.
Where's the next person with a comment? Bill, over here in the corner.
Some of you are familiar with George Gilder's The Naked Nomad, which was one of the favorite books of Ronald Reagan. He gives you some statistics in there on the difference between young unmarried males and married males. Young unmarried males have less sex, less money, more prison time, and poorer health than married males. George Gilder comes to the conclusion then that it is the fault of the feminists for going their own way and turning all of these savage young males with testosterone and alcohol ridden loose on society.
And Lionel Tiger, Bill, has written a book about whether males are even needed anymore. So, I mean, we can take that another step further. We have another over here.
Yes. Yeah. You talked about literacy, and I'd like to go another little direction, television. I mean, I'm stuck somewhere between the kind of PBS idea that I associate with it, this instrument can teach, somewhere between there and the reports that came out that I heard today on the radio that said, you know, hey, more violence for more people who are watching more television. Just any comments you might have.
The main thing I worry about with television is that in the honors classes I teach, freshman year, first year, they are not writing as well as they used to 10 years ago. And my suspicion is that they're watching other people speak and using a poorer vocabulary than they would if they had been doing more reading themselves. The violence, I don't know. Like all of you, I try to follow that in the newspapers, but I suspect you could say intelligent comments to each other as good as anything I could say.
The inevitability of technology is interesting. It goes back to Ken's question. When Bill Plank brought Stuart Kaufman here a couple years ago, I interviewed him and asked him about cloning. And he said, well, let's see how the law comes down on this. We have a lawyer back here. Does it make any difference how the law comes down on cloning? Isn't it going to happen anyway? Tom?
Thanks for putting me on the spot, Mark.
It's all right. It's my pleasure.
I have no expertise in cloning at all, but I think that's right.
Making a law against cloning won't make any difference.
Right, and I think that's the point that Michael made a moment ago. We can try to write rules, but there's a level at which behavior is behavior, and a law always comes along afterwards, kinds of thinks about it and figures out how we're going to maybe punish it. Maybe that's the revenge component in a way that the law satisfies rather than doing it in advance. I don't know.
Well, one legal philosopher says that the law is institutionalized vengeance. It's taking out of the hand of the individual and putting it in the hands of the state so that we don't have total chaos in that department. Is that too far off?
I hope that's not a description of my practice.
Do we have another over here? Yes, go ahead.
Well, I grabbed the microphone to say something about this guy's comment about television. But then I realized that we were talking about this over here. But that, I think that, you know, that's a really good point, you know.
Speak a little closer to the microphone. Thank you.
The television part, and I think commercialism in general, and specifically I wanted to point out what's happening April 2nd and 3rd with the International Business Convention, and which brings me to what we're talking about here. Where do we draw the line with the genetic engineering? Do we just cure illness, or do we program people to think certain ways?
Program society to think certain ways about genetic engineering?
No, about things like international business and commercialism.
Globalism.
Exploiting. Okay. Basically, I called in earlier. I don't know if that went over the air or not. I called the radio station. I said something about we refer to as primitive culture, hunting and gathering, and I said that don't we do that all the time? I've learned way too much about how we're treating our people now, to our people being the world's people, to not worry about things like people getting rich off of prescription drugs and stuff like that, which I think we could go further into that at another time. But as far as genetic engineering and that kind of thing and what's going to happen, I mean, it's pretty important. And I'm glad that this is happening tonight.
Have our ethics evolved, Michael?
I also teach business students. And some of them are very, very sensitive people. Some of them are people who are very open to the kind of moral and ethical considerations that are raised in religious studies, my field, and philosophy. And I'm very happy about that. But I do have the sense, and maybe I'm sympathizing with you now, that an awful lot of the other students are more like the testosterone-ridden males or the people willing to follow their warlord, say, at Enron, and succeed and conquer and make more money. And how do we restrain that impulse? How do we channel it the right way? Just by raising the question and just by my repeating it, I think you can all sit there and sort of nod and say, yeah, that's the problem. What do we do about it? The university I teach at requires that every single business student takes a business ethics course. I don't know what the impact is. I don't know how strong it is. Every engineering student takes an engineering ethics course, and everybody in pre-med takes a medical ethics course. But we can do that because we're a private university. I wouldn't mind at all if every university in the United States had some kind of requirement like that. I don't know how effective it would be, but at least it's worth trying.
I think you're onto something there in terms of why we're having these lectures. What can we do in our education system, whether it's elementary, secondary, or higher education, to bring critical thinking about real issues? And I assume the real issues are what we find in our classical literature and in ethical discussions of the past and that sort of thing, ethical systems of the past. How do we get that in our curriculum? Does anybody realize the importance of it? I mean, you just said you assume it's important for every one of those majors. Isn't it important for everybody who's going to live in the modern world?
Yes, I agree enthusiastically with that. This, I think some of you know, is an old, old argument in United States education To what extent are we educating people for professions? To what extent are we educating them for being better human beings when they get that extra social authority that comes from being in the profession? And the latter is of such obvious benefit to everybody that it just feels like a crying shame. We don't feel that more strongly, that the public doesn't feel that more strongly, that the legislatures don't feel it more strongly, that the money doesn't flow adequately, at least in that direction. But as I said, it's been a long-standing battle, and it'll keep going on, I guess.
Sandy?
You seem to draw some cause-effect relationship between the evolution of literacy and the evolution of some kind of civility. Is that correct?
Yes, a historical correlation. I can't say that I can see why one would cause the other.
There are other views of the nature of literacy which would contradict that. For instance, a woman by the name of Elsbeth Stuckey, who writes a book called The Violence of Literacy, suggests that literacy is a tactic or a tool which we can use in any way that we please. It doesn't necessarily change our behavior or our inclinations, that those things evolve somewhere else, and that then we use written language technology in order to achieve our ends, whatever they may be, and some of our ends are quite violent, regardless of whether we know how to read or write or not.
I think it's certainly true, and I like your expression, the technology of literacy. It is a technology that can be used for any purpose. Kittler did a brilliant job at a literate style of persuading people to follow him to obvious, horrible results. So the further question is, to what use is literacy put? What is its content and what are its goals? And it's not, literacy by itself is not going to accomplish good things. But it looks as though historically it has to be in the package to give us the cognitive complexity tools to be able to stand back from the questions you're raising and raise them the way you are raising them, to think about them in that level of subtlety.
Now, there's a Jesuit scholar by the name of Walter J. Ong, who published in 1982, his book is called The Technology of the Word, I believe. And his argument is, and this is akin to Luria, the Russian linguist, he suggests that there are cognitive consequences that come along with any technology, including print technology, and that those cognitive consequences have led us to the development of a different system of logic. But he doesn't say that that system of logic is any better necessarily than logics which evolve in cultures that are based in oral narrative, but simply that we have displaced ourselves from the life world, from describing our experience in terms of the life world when we become literate.
I argued that point with Father Ong some years ago.
You know him?
Yes. I was at St. Louis when he was there. Didn't really know him that well then, introduced, but we belong to a couple of the same societies because he's interested in religious studies. I found his knowledge of oral cultures to be, to borrow a word here, a little thin. I'm trying to think of the name of a woman who is famous for her work. She's a leader in how to take oral histories. I first ran across her maybe 30 years ago. She does a very good job of defending oral cultures very strongly, of appreciating the beauty of their literacy, of the aspects of humanists that they can get at, of the poetry involved and so forth. But even with all those wonderful things, she nonetheless admits that there's a level of complexity that they can't get to just because the brain runs out of steam when your thought gets too long. There are people who can memorize and who do memorize the entire Quran, for example. Now, that's a lot of words. But you put that book down alongside of the other 10,000 in your library or 100,000 or a million in some libraries, and you begin to realize how much literacy can make available to us that we can look up, cross-compare, write out in a new elongated form with logical sequencing. It's abstract very often. Very often it's dull and boring. Sometimes it's wonderful literature, Macbeth, go through Shakespeare's corpus kind of thing. But it's more than. It's not necessarily better than oral culture simply, but it can do things that orality alone can't do.
Doesn't that make literacy, Lynn, like any other technology, morally neutral?
Sure.
Yeah.
It can cut both ways, good and bad. Yeah. You don't agree with that, I guess. Okay.
Go ahead.
I wanted to get back to the term you used in your title, I guess. I wasn't sure that you gave us a full description, I guess, or definition of how you're using the term. That is humane. The examples you use, seem to be identifying being humane with a lower homicide rate. At times, you suggested kind of a sense, an appreciation for diversity. A moment ago, you seemed to suggest that you're using it in a way that's synonymous with civility. Do you have a more expanded definition of the types of criteria that you would use to decide whether something would be humane or not?
In a sense, I do. Some of the teaching I do is in ethics. And, of course, you have to define what you mean by the good. But once you try to do that, as you probably know, it gets incredibly difficult. Martha Nussbaum and a few others recently have used the expression human flourishing to talk about what they think the goal of an ethic is. I think that's a good expression. It's a little pallid to me. It just doesn't quite have the vigor or the strength or the incentive to do and dare more. But I can't say that I have better things. I use human well-being sometimes as the expression. We can recognize the negatives, I think, much better. When people are suffering unnecessarily, when people are dying unnecessarily, that's bad. When there are homicides and rape and psychological torture, this is evil. Whatever it takes to stop that is more humane. So at least we can have a ground basis we can work upwards from.
Would you say, though, that we've perhaps replaced more overt forms of violence with more insidious forms of violence? That if you were to try to, maybe we're trying to compare apples and oranges with statistics, and could a case be made that perhaps we're no less violent for our civilization, but we're more elegant in the way that we're violent?
Do you have an instance? Do you have something in mind about?
Well, as the gentleman was talking about selling pharmaceutical drugs, or you mentioned Enron yourself. I guess in some ways, the kinds of violence that we do to people, although it allows them to live, the question is, do they flourish? And do we make it easier or more difficult to flourish, even with all of our literacy and cultural heritage and so on?
I think probably the best answer I can give to that is to say that you've raised a very important question. We might be doing violence to each other and to other people in all kinds of ways we can't calibrate yet, we don't recognize yet, and that we ought to keep learning. After that, we open the door to one of those endless sets of arguments about who's hurting whom and how many ways that I suspect everybody in this room has engaged in, because it's so hard to know for sure. And in 500 years, somebody can look back and make their judgment on us, and it may be a harsh one, maybe harsher than I think we deserve at this time. I mean, where do we get such wonderful people in this room, after all? We must be doing something right.
In 40 years of working in the media, I saw a foreign correspondent tearful on television last week for the first time, one of the best foreign correspondents, Christiane Amanpour, who works for CNN. The interviewer said, "What happened in Rwanda?" And the more she talked about it, tears started running down her cheeks, and she said, "The politicians failed, the press failed, humanity failed." And that's what happened. And it happens other places as well.
Yeah.
And so it, in a sense, says what responsibility governments and the Fourth Estate and on and on and on have. We went in where Milosevic was the murderer, but we didn't go in. Tom?
I was going to play devil's advocate for just a moment here. It seems to me you could say, well, if we're going to judge people by flourishing, by well-being, and you look around this room in a very wealthy country, wealthy because of free enterprise, wealthy because not because of ethics courses that are taught in business schools or law schools or pharmacy schools or anywhere else, but because people are out trying to make money and trying to do things for themselves, one could say that ethics is irrelevant to the well-being of people based on that kind of analysis. And it's not something I particularly buy, but I'd like to have your response to it.
My immediate inclination is to argue with that. You may be right. But over the last 5,000 years, I think we probably have done better. I think that all of those people who are in business either have something of a conscience or at least can be embarrassed in ways that people in prior generations couldn't. Over the 5,000 years, maybe my optimism is justified. I want to go back to the point that there's great evils of this century. Maybe in the short term, it is wiser to focus on how we have failed rather than to celebrate achievements, because those failures are what we have to take care of so they don't happen again in the future, or to the extent we can.
Brian?
I'd like to pick up on this idea of subtle violence, or not so subtle violence, but more subtle than the past. I happen to be on your side of the argument. I think we have the potential to make significant progress, and I think we've laid ethical foundations. I'd like you to comment on one aspect of that. It seems to me that the concept of human equality that developed, I guess, post-Enlightenment, toward the end of the Enlightenment, is foundational to any effective functioning ethics in a global world. I'd like you to comment on it. But the bad side of it is, it seemed to me, the sort of the unfulfilled reality of it is, I just saw a UN report that 11 million children die every year of preventable disease. Now, if that's not violence imposed by the wealthy on the non-wealthy, I don't know what is. 1.2 billion people live on less than a dollar a day. So I think some of our wealth, if one was going to look at it, comes from that, as it has historically. Could you comment on the human equality concept in terms of how important that is in potentially reaching a world that is humane in your terms?
We're down to our last 3 minutes, by the way. So.
I think the value of human equality is one of the great achievements of the civilized world, although I should point out that egalitarianism is one of the fundamental values, as it were, of foraging cultures. Although, you have to qualify that, for most of them, it means all the men are equal to all the other men. And so the notion that Mary Wollstonecraft proposed to the Enlightenment, that women are just as damn good as men, has been a significant achievement.
Could I ask you one last question, Michael? Isn't part of our problem that we are animals with big brains who pretend to be lower than the angels? We pretend to be in an order of reality that we really are not in, that the dark sidedness is just as powerful as any other side, and that requires not only the teaching of ethics, but lots of communication with each other about who we really are. Human nature, we act like human nature is something settled. And is it settled?
No, I agree with you entirely. Not everybody in my field does agree with you. They think the human spirit is fixed, but I think that our realization of spirit is something that's been taking place over thousands of years, and we have a long way to go. And we better think of it as something that's developing, not as something that's done.
Our guest this evening has been Dr. Michael Barnes of the University of Dayton, who is the author of Stages of Thought, The Coevolution of Religious Thought and Science. We've had a wonderful group of people here at Sissel Recital Hall posing questions and making comments. And I want to thank you, Dr. Barnes, for coming to Billings.
Very welcome. My pleasure.